This is Rewind.
I think people do use the weather forecast differently than they did 10 years ago, not just because we have it so accessible in our phones, but because it's kind of quietly gotten better. I don't know what the good version of, like, you know, frogs in a boiling pot is, but like we now kind of make plans for the weekend on Tuesday because we're pretty confident with that Saturday forecast.
It's an unspecified day, January 1977. We're inside CBS's Ed Sullivan Theater, a 13-story brick building at 1697 Broadway, New York, New York. This venerable venue got its name from the world-famous Ed Sullivan Show. Since then, it's been host to a number of game shows, including today's entry, the $128,000 question. The cameras roll as today's contestant, June Bacon Bursey, stands enclosed in a glass soundproof isolation booth, dressed in a crisp collared shirt, and with her dark hair in a neat updo. If anyone can handle the pressure of answering a series of increasingly difficult questions on a topic of their choosing, it's her. You know, before we get into this daring game show, let me tell you a little more about June. This well-coiffed woman is one of the country's most accomplished scientists. In 1954, she became the first Black woman ever to graduate college with a degree in meteorology. And it came as no surprise. June's been obsessed with the field ever since she was a teen, when a picture of a nuclear explosion on the cover of Time magazine piqued her interest. After finishing school, this inquisitive young scientist went on to build quite the resume, working at the National Meteorological Center, the U.S. Atomic Energy Commission, and as an on-air weather reporter, smashing stigmas against female meteorologists, who are derisively known as, quote-unquote, weather girls. Now, she's taking on her latest challenge, winning the $128,000 question. If June makes it to the end, the payout is $64,000, the equivalent of some $350,000 in the early 21st century, and the chance to move on to a tournament of champions where the winner doubles their money, hence the $128,000. But enough background. Let's see how June does. From one question to the next, June has, thus far, made it through the game show's gauntlet unscathed. She now awaits the final $64,000 question. Given her education, you might think it would be about the science of thermodynamics or the intricacies of atomic energy. But no, she chooses a topic that may seem completely out of left field. John Philip Sousa, famed composer of The Stars and Stripes Forever. Ah, but June's the daughter of a music teacher. She became obsessed with Sousa's work while listening to it on her drive to work. And now, these rousing, patriotic marching band tunes hold the key to unlocking this incredible scientist's dreams. The lights dim until June is the only one visible, illuminated in the isolation booth's orange glow. The host waits with bated breath as an electric typewriter prints out the question. Host Mike Darrow then reads it. Sousa's successor as head of the Marine Band was once arrested for refusing to play a Sousa march. Name him. June takes a moment to think. Then, she slowly responds, Francesco Fanciulli. And she's right. Lights flash as the crowd goes wild in celebration. But our big winner's reaction is a little more muted. Sure, she's smiling, but there's still work to be done. June plans to use the money to establish a scholarship for women to study meteorology. And even though she doesn't go on to win the full $128,000, her final sum is more than enough to fund her scholarship, which will continue to be awarded right into the 21st century. It's the perfect way to honor her legacy, cementing her and many more to come as much more than weather girls. So, why did I share this inspiring anecdote about a trailblazing weather scientist? Besides the fact that June Bacon Bursey is someone worth knowing about, I wanted to illustrate that getting an accurate weather forecast takes so much more than just opening an app on your phone. It takes the collective work and dedication of some of the country's most brilliant scientists, just like the incredible woman from this story. They're meteorologists from the National Weather Service, which is part of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. And it's not just about telling you if you'll need an umbrella when you go out for groceries. The NWS provides vital weather, water, and climate data, as well as forecasts, warnings for the protection of life and property, to say nothing of its role in national security. All of this boosts productivity, mitigates weather-related losses, and helps fuel a multi-billion-dollar commercial weather industry. According to a study by the American Meteorological Society, every dollar invested in the NWS generates an estimated $73 in economic value. So not a bad way to spend your tax dollars. And definitely so much more than a few icons on your favorite weather app. Welcome to Government That Doesn't Suck. I'm your professor, Greg Jackson.
And I'm your professor, Lindsay Cormack. Talking about the weather can be considered small talk. You might have an older adult in your life who's always obsessing over the weather in your area, theirs, and anyone else's. And then sometimes there's news organizations that are always talking about extreme weather events, and we can get scared about these things. But most of us take for granted how nice it is to have a 10-day weather forecast easily accessible on our phone. Today, we are going to talk about the fascinating history of how we got to forecasting as we have it in the United States with Andrew Blum. He's the author of The Weather Machine, A Journey Inside the Forecast, and he's going to tell us about the origins, the problems, the pitfalls, and successes. Andrew, thank you so much for joining us on Government That Doesn't Suck.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
I want to start really far in our history. I want to go back to the 1870s when we're just completing the railway system. We've connected the continent, but we haven't quite connected the weather piece. Can you tell us what the impetus was for having some sort of national approach to weather?
Well, it was two things. There was a kind of social need and there was a technological advance. I mean, the social need was kind of shipwrecks on the Great Lakes. That was something. It wasn't so much about protecting commerce or creating a product that had an economic value, but the recognition that government should protect its citizens. And one way its citizens were spectacularly not being protected was in Great Lake gales. So in the 1870s, there was that initial push to try to predict storms on the lakes, the recognition that weather often moved from west to east in the U.S. And so if you could, at the very least, give advance notice of what was coming, then that would be a starting point. The technological piece of that, of course, is the rise of the telegraph system.
So before we get to the telegraph system, I have a question. Mm-hmm. Some people would think that we did weather in order to predict things for farmers. So it might be something that we found in the Department of Agriculture or the sort of like nascent budding pieces of that. But this actually starts in the Department of War. Is that correct?
Yes. There is a kind of... I mean, it's interrupted sort of very dramatically within almost a decade by the Civil War. So you have a kind of, just before the Civil War, you have the original Smithsonian Institution that had a network of weather observers and put in the lobby of their new headquarters in the Mall in Washington, a giant map that began to consolidate the first telegraph forecasts. So you have a rise of the telegraph just about that time. And then you have the recognition that each telegraph operator could chime in each morning with the conditions in their local place. And then suddenly you have this real-time view of what the weather is across the expanse of the continent. Of course, it didn't go all the way across the continent, but halfway across at that point. And then it's interrupted by the war.
So you're saying we get the pieces in place, and the Smithsonian Institute is not necessarily a governmental institute. It's sort of like quasi-governmental because it's funded by the government, but it's independent. And was it their idea to say yes, let's house this here? Or is it something where the United States federal government says, you're going to be our partner in figuring this out?
That's a good question. I mean, my understanding is that it was a scientific endeavor to begin with. So the Smithsonian was a scientific institution, and it was very interested in this idea of a coherent United States. It was very interested in the idea, that there was a not just new technologies available, but also a kind of new image of the nation as a whole. And sort of what better way to demonstrate that than when you open your brand new headquarters building on the relatively new mall in Washington, than by putting up a giant map that, I mean, again, it's so familiar to us now. I have trouble kind of recognizing the novelty of it, but to know the conditions across a huge expanse simultaneously, it's like a huge leap of imagination that only happens when you have a technology like the telegraph.
So will you help me picture that? When you say that they had a map of the United States, was it a physical map where they'd have rain clouds if it was raining in Mississippi or sun if it's sunny in Florida? Or how did they sort of visualize it for people?
There was a map, and the way it's described there were paper discs that were slid on top of each nail on the place. And the paper discs were color-coded for different conditions. It's in my book. I can't remember right off the top of my head, but it's gray for clouds, blue for sun. And what was a kind of new recognition was that if you get those conditions in, you might start to see what, again, is familiar to us today, but the sort of fronts passing from west to east. Why west of a certain line is it clear, and east of a certain line is it cloudy? You kind of might know intuitively that the storms are coming from the west, but to actually begin to have a kind of continental scale imagination of that is totally new. And it's a kind of perfect Smithsonian stuff, because it's both scientific and it's technological, and it depends on a coherent United States.
And when you say that it's coming in, the telegraph makes it possible. Are these telegraph stations that are set up on military bases, or where do they all come from to send the information to DC?
It's entirely overlaid along the railroad tracks. So you have telegraph lines paralleling railroad tracks. You have one infrastructure on top of another. And then you have the telegraph operators, at each railroad depot. And each morning they had to test the line. So it was decided that the great way to test the line would be to send a weather report down it.
Oh, so it's just like the wake up to say like, hey, here's what, it's sunny right now, or it's 68 degrees. Or
with the added complication that it worked poorly in the rain. So the initial lines didn't work very well if it were raining.
Okay, so it's like, but maybe that's a signal too. It's like, we can't get the call from whatever. Maybe it's raining there right now.
Exactly.
So can you tell me, why is it that this is something that government had to do instead of private industry? Why is it not that there was, people who were concerned about the weather in their area that could have made some money on saying, like, let me figure this out? What was this? Was it the scale, or why did it have to be government?
Well, a few things. I mean, one is that, where it's this, again, this weird condition of life that we stay in one part, in one place, but the weather, kind of the atmosphere, moves above us. The atmosphere is always circulating around the Earth. And so you immediately need a kind of more expansive geographic view to think about weather forecasting. This is a big country, so that can be a national view. It doesn't have to be yet an international view, although it certainly becomes a very international view. And then there's also the recognition that the kind of business model of this is a little vague. But what's absolutely clear is that weather can be dangerous, and there is a real need, or a real recognition that one of the responsibilities of government is to protect its citizens. And one way to protect its citizens is to warn of upcoming storms.
If the telegram is the first tech that makes things mm-hmm. possible, where do we place things like weather balloons and satellites? And like, what is the sort of like development from like, yes, we can Morse code to each other what's happening here, to what we have today, which are AI systems who are sort of like feeding in more information every day?
Yeah, it's a great question. So always there is the sort of technological piece, but then there's also the social piece. There's also the recognition that, you may have the technology to collect the observations, whether a thermometer or a weather balloon or a radar or eventually a weather satellite. But you also need the wherewithal to share them, and you need the institutions that are responsible for sharing them. And one of the things that becomes really crucial is the recognition that the weather is global. And that's, in the U.S., again, is a little bit exceptional with that because we're so big. But in the same era, in the sort of 1880s, 1890s, there was a real kind of a sort of vogue for standardization. There were big global expositions. There was a...
When you say standardization, you mean like measurements?
Okay. Measurements, the meter.
Fahrenheit v. Celsius
Exactly. Okay. All kind of at the same moment. So you have kind of initial rise of American prominence. So you have this period, before the turn of the 20th century, when American scientists and American government officials were spending a lot of time at big European conventions, and one of the things that was established along with the meter was the international exchange of weather data.
Okay, so it becomes like a forum for cooperation.
Yeah, absolutely. It's sort of a UN before the UN, and not to jump ahead, but it becomes the weather becomes a UN agency essentially. But there's a clear recognition that this is something that governments do for their citizens, and this is something that governments share among each other. And those two pieces are as much, are as important as the technological ability to collect weather observations and rapidly share them.
So then does this all break down in World War I? Is there something where then people are like no longer sharing, or were those not yet established in a way where it was a detriment?
It's interesting. The World War I history, there was a break in the networks, and the forecast becomes sort of a major military advantage. The more interesting component of that is the World War II history, because the technology was more sophisticated. So you both had aviation, and you had that was the key piece. And so the in World War II, the most famous story is the D-Day story, where it was the forecast for D-Day and the postponement of the invasion by a day that was incredibly consequential in the result.
And what are the technologies at that time that underlie that?
The technologies of that time were the radio telegraph. So you actually had the ability to send observations from distant points, most notably kind of around the edge of the Atlantic, as well as observations from ships. And that resulted in, some really intense sort of competition, culminating in this kind of amazing episode where the Nazis put remote weather stations along the Canadian coast. It's the only known incursion in North America during the war.
Oh, wait, hold on. I loved this in your book. I love this where you're like, it's like a little box or something, and they tried to disguise it as Canadian, or they wrote Canadian Weather Service on it.
They scattered American cigarettes around it. So like if anyone found it, they would just think it was some weird, Canadian US military piece of equipment, not a Nazi piece of equipment.
So this is a German piece of equipment that's sending back some sort of read on weather in the continental United States.
It's a self-contained radio system that's sending radioing observations back to Germany in order to produce forecasts for the military, which were very competitive. If you knew what the storms were going to do, that made a major difference.
And especially for air power, I imagine, because this is sort of like the beginning of a lot of air power as the way that militaries wage war. And so I imagine that's like much more important. This goes undetected, right? Like we don't figure that out until many years later.
Yeah, we don't. No one finds this remote observation station until the 70s, I think.
And how did it get found?
Like a science expedition sort of came upon it, and we're like, "This seems really odd. What is this?" And then I think at some point around the same time, it was the sort of details of it were uncovered in the German archives.
I really enjoyed that in your book because, I've never heard anything about Germans having any peace in the continental United States in this. And I was like, "Oh wow, that's like a very big little hidden nugget of history."
Yeah. And again, indicative of the lengths that governments will go for a good weather forecast, whether to protect their troops or protect their citizens, and indicative as well of the importance of the exchange of that data, and then the drama of what happens when that exchange is broken by war.
So I have one more D-Day question, and then I want to shift forward a little bit in history. But my question is, when we're making the decision on whether or not we're going to go in, where are the weather pieces being sent to? Like, where is that decision making happening?
It's happening in the UK, in London. It's at headquarters there. But it requires as many observations as possible from the North Atlantic. So it's this effort. That's always the case with weather forecasting. More and better observations, over time allow the kind of map to be assembled. The weather is coming from the North Atlantic, and there's this huge effort to collect it all. And then a sort of pretty limited understanding of how the weather systems come together and interact with each other. That's complex stuff, both scientifically and also from a kind of computational sense, just how to sort of understand what the patterns are going to be. At the time, it was all pattern matching. It was, this happened before, we think it's going to happen again. Like literally almost like going back to the sort of, pattern books and saying, okay, when the observations were this in this spot and here, this in that spot, what happened next?
So you're saying it's not modeling in the way that we might think of it today, where it's like, given these measurements, we can model version one, version two, version whatever. This is given that we have this information and all the past history we have, seems like it might be that.
Yeah. And amazingly, the understanding of the physics of the model existed in World War II, but there was no computation to undertake it.
Okay, so when you say that it's like we understand different pieces of atmosphere and pressures and temperature and water and humidity and whatever, but the ability to calculate all those different measurements into something that's meaningful just isn't feasible.
Yeah, and I'll say, I mean, it's so before supercomputers, and we'll get to that. But before supercomputers, long before, is you know, even around World War One, there was an understanding of the equations, the physical equations under which, you know, by which the atmosphere operates. But there were no observations, and there was no ability to calculate those equations fast enough to make a useful forecast, which I really mean to make a forecast that is you're done calculating it before the weather arrives.
Yeah, like by the time you've like said, oh, I think there's going to be a blizzard and I have all the math to have done it, the blizzard is here.
If it takes you six weeks to figure out what the weather is going to be in 2 days, that's not very useful.
Yeah. So is the next tech that we move to then the supercomputer? Is this like the 1950s or when do we start to get to something like that?
Yeah, I mean, you have this always the social piece and the technological piece. You have the technological piece of computers, you know, just electronic computers, and then of satellites. So you have a more comprehensive view. You know, so both of those are sort of, you know, American space age inventions in a lot of ways. You know, coming into their own in the 60s and 70s, and then you have the social impetus to want to recognize the atmosphere as a sort of a shared global thing, and to recognize that weather forecasting, particularly past 2 or 3 days, depends on an understanding of the atmosphere at a global scale.
And a lot of that seems really intertwined in space. Something that I learned in your book is we have like JFK's speech on how we're going to put a man on the moon, but there's also this component that's like, and we're going to get better at weather. Will you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, it's a crazy sort of lost piece of history that, you know, 30 seconds after he says in that famous words that we've all heard so many times, you know, before the decade is out, you know, put a man on the moon, endeavor to put a man on the moon. Like point three is like, we're also going to build weather satellites for global weather observation. You know, no one ever talks about that part, but it's like but we live it every day. We know all those pieces. And so it was really about, you know, Kennedy's vision of American supremacy that's both technical as well as sort of diplomatic, and a, you know, huge effort to build the systems that achieve that. And there are kind of joint sort of military and sort of social aims with that. You know, the weather observation, the satellites for weather observation at the time are sort of identical to the satellites for espionage. But it is, you know, the technologies go hand in hand. But it is amazing to me that as much as that, in kind of true Kennedy fashion, it also was about a vision of sort of global cooperation. It was a UN, entirely with this, you know, rise of the UN driven by the US.
So I guess it sort of makes sense, though, if we think his sort of vision for space was not necessarily to weaponize it, but was to say, like, this is going to be good for all of us, the atmosphere, the upper atmosphere, or I don't know all the science atmosphere parts, but like that also seems aligned with this notion that if we are in one sort of global unit, then we should have these developed for peaceful ends versus not.
I mean, I would say both at every stage. You know, it's really both that it's, you know, the idea of kind of American empire, you know, peaceful American empire at that time, was part and parcel with this sort of scientific effort. You know, that it wasn't as if, no, this was entirely for peaceful aims, but it really was about a projection of American power. And the weather forecast and the World Meteorological Organization as an invention sort of, you know, in many ways kind of bankrolled and instituted by the U.S. as a U.N. organization, was really about the kind of showing what American science and technology could bring to people all around the world. When I did my reporting for the book, when I went to the World Meteorological Organization Congress every 4 years in 2015, the real question was the second biggest delegation after the U.S. was the Chinese delegation.
So that's a change.
Yep, that was a change.
And I actually, when you went there, you said something to me, and you'll have to correct me if I'm wrong, but it struck me that the United States like doesn't send their best. They send like the B team and everyone else sends their A team, or is that a misread?
It wasn't so much the B team, but it was a little bit of like, we're not going to send our actual director, we're going to send like the assistant director because we're so big that this is sort of not the most important thing. I hadn't expected going into it how much bigger, you know, how much the U.S. was the elephant in the room. You know, the U.S. is the primary funder of the organization by virtue of its proportion of UN funding. And, you know, and that, that should have been a clue to begin with. But in terms of influence, that there had been a shift in the balance of that, primarily because of the European success at weather forecasting, over the last 30 years or so.
Okay, so maybe we can get into that. It sounds like the United States started this and said, like, we want to have a global sort of acceptance that we're all going to do weather forecasting together because we're all interconnected. They start that. They're competing with the USSR at the time in the sense that there's like a race to see whose satellites can do this better. And the sort of tech that you're using for, I think you said espionage, but like reconnaissance satellites are sort of the same or the exact same as weather satellites. Is that?
In the early days, they're the same. They're a camera. Now they're not the same, but in the early days, they're absolutely the same.
Okay, so they start off the same. The United States, it's not clear that they're going to win, but they do sort of come out on top here. When does the European model or the European system start to be the more accurate one or the one that we rely on more?
Yeah, so beginning in the 1970s, you have the European Union, and you have a real concerted effort to determine what they can compete best with. You know, where, what are the sort of possibilities for competition with, you know, with both Russia and the US? And the sort of scientific cooperation was a key one. And then it's like, okay, well, what's the most useful scientific cooperation? And they build a giant, they start building a giant fusion power plant, which still isn't finished. But then they also build up their weather capabilities. And that had two parts. And the weather forecast always has two parts. It's the observations, and then it's the computation. And so the observation parts came from a European weather satellite cooperation. And so there, the European nations are working together to fly their own weather satellites, which only, for the most part, the US and China had done before. So now there are, and they're very good at it. They're kind of, the scientific cooperation yields a lot of really good instruments and a lot of, you know, successful kind of competence in doing it. And then equally importantly, they start doing their own weather models. And the weather models, until very recently, well, arguably still today, are also kind of big nation state projects. They require supercomputers. They require kind of a huge, you know, sucking up of all available global weather data. And then there's like a lot of kind of, you know, magic and elegance in sort of making them run as properly as possible, and to have the most accurate forecast. And the Europeans prove really good at that. The cooperation there with the ECMWF, which is the European Center for Medium Range Weather Forecasting, medium range meaning like at the time 3 to 5 days, now it's more like 3 to 10 days, becomes very competitive, if not better, than the equivalent systems weather models run by the American, the National Weather Service.
So you said this transition happened in the 70s?
Well, they Europeans started working on it in the 70s. It was the Euro, which was the sort of the European weather model, kind of came into its own like around 2010, 2012. That was when the world sort of recognized that this was really, you know, better than its U.S. equivalent. And this is a kind of favorite horse race among meteorologists. You know, it's not definitively better. Some days it's better, some days it isn't. And that really, but it, once you're better, it's kind of easier to kind of pull ahead. And that had been primarily the track over the last, the kind of, you know, call it 2010 to 2022 period or so. And then things shift again with the arrival of AI, which I have to be honest, you know, if you had asked me this in 2019, I would have said, no, it's all about the physics. It's all about the supercomputers. But the AI models are proving very successful with a few caveats.
And is that something that the United States is also doing the AI pieces, China's doing the AI pieces, but Europe's just doing it better?
Well, it's interesting. In order to have an AI weather model, you, of course, still need weather observations. And not only that, but you need those observations arranged into like a database of the atmosphere. So you need to have a way, the scientists call it, to assimilate your current observations with what you understand the observations were yesterday. It kind of all has to line up. You know, so that in itself is a complicated process, and that process still entirely depends on the old weather models. So a lot of the AI sort of upstart AI models relied primarily on the Europeans' existing model as a starting point. So you can't run your AI model without a sort of perfect view of the atmosphere, you know, at the point you're starting your forecast. And it's the European model that gives you that sort of, you know, packaged up kind of perfect database of the atmosphere as it exists.
Okay, so it's like the structure and history of the data permit this to be done better because it was like better input, so you're going to get better output.
Yeah, and a spirit of cooperation. So pretty much from the beginning, Google, NVIDIA, Panasonic, a bunch of people wanted to work with this data. And, you know, and the National Weather Service was like, oh, okay, well, we'll try to figure this out. And the Europeans were like, we'll figure this out right now. And we're going to work with you and have it entirely be open. And we're going to let you run your AI model, you know, right alongside our kind of production physics model, you know, the model that everybody relies on every day. And actually just in May 2026, they sort of kind of turned over and said, you know, job done. You know, we don't need to host these models anymore because we now understand what the interaction is between the physics model and the way it shows you the observations at this moment and what the AI models can predict. And so they kind of separated it again, but then they also started running their own AI model. So it's not just that the AI replaces it, but it does kind of get a little bit more accurate, and it's a lot more efficient. Like it just runs faster, and then you run it more often. It's been pretty remarkable. I did not see it coming at all, but it's also like, it's so easy to say, oh, out with the old, when in fact it doesn't work without the telegraph. Like it doesn't work if you don't have the same weather stations collecting data every day. And that's actually something that the World Meteorological Organization recognized and sort of doubled down and was like, you know, we actually need like old school ground observations from everywhere on Earth. And the countries that can't pay for their own weather services, we're going to create a new fund to make sure that we get, you know, just old school basic thermometer on the ground, you know, everywhere so that we can properly run the AI models.
So I'm glad you said that because I wanted to ask about this. You have a part in your book where you say, like, just like in the secondhand cell phone market, there too are secondhand satellites, secondhand tech. That's essentially what populates the global south to do this work. Is that what you're saying when you say, like, a country who can't pay for it, we subsidize this? Or how do satellites move from, like, they might have been in employment in the United States and then now they're going to be in somewhere in Latin America? Is that, like, sort of where they go, or how does it work?
Yeah, the satellites, you might sort of shift their orbit to have a view farther south. That's one example. But more literally, it's like there's now like a newly invigorated grant program to make sure, you know, every African nation has the state-of-the-art weather station at its airport. And so as much as there's like a whole conversation happening about the privatization of weather data, and there's a lot of sort of really interesting startups in the US that are collecting weather data in new ways, there is still this kind of, you know, essentially UN-based effort to make sure that that we just have the system that we started thinking about, you know, 130 years ago, where we just know the temperature and the pressure, you know, for as many places on Earth with as much accuracy as possible.
So I want to talk about the privatization thing in a minute, but when you say that it's at airports, is this like the equivalent as how it was at railroads? It's like, but now we're going to do it at the other big traffic part?
Yeah, exactly. And of course, airports, you know, have a huge need for good weather forecast because it's, you know, for safety reasons. But so you have a kind of often, you know, the kind of primary observation place is at an airport. Although there, you know, in some places there's kind of great history about where it ends up. You know, in New York, you know, the Reading and Central Park is the main one, of course. But it's just remarkable to me that even with all this high tech push, you know, over the last 18 months, the World Meteorological Organization has been like, shoot, we better fund, weather offices around the world like we have been for 100 years. We can't let that go because it's just as important to get those observations, even, you know, if we're just, you know, snapping out the incredible forecast with a, you know, desktop, you know, with a, like literally like an AI model running on a desktop.
So when you say the last few months, is this something where like the One Big Beautiful Bill changes funding, or is there something that changed where it was like the reprioritization of this money had to go somewhere?
Well, this was I'm talking at the international level. So this was at the World Meteorological Organization that recognized that there had to be a concerted effort to make sure there was funding for these weather stations around the world. You know, the WMO meets every 4 years as a as a Congress, and that's been the case for, you know, even before it was the WMO for 100 years, before there was a UN, there was a UN of weather. And the situation in the last few years was so extreme that they had an extraordinary session. They added a Congress because the technology was changing so fast that they realized they had to make sure this exchange of data was continuing in a way that kept meteorology doing what it's been doing better, not just well, but doing what it's been doing better and better for 150 years.
Is there like a coherent case for having NOAA, instead of doing it themselves, having private entities that are doing all sorts of things that they might be doing with their satellites, just like tack on sort of like, hey, and observe some weather and send it back to us? Or is it something that NOAA should always run those tech pieces there on their own?
Yeah, well, I'll be honest. When I started reporting my book and had to find a story that showed, how the weather satellites work, this would have been 2015, 2016. The bureaucracy and the confusion and the sort of, it was a challenged organization, NOAA and the Satellite Bureau and the National Weather Service. There was just a ton of bureaucracy with it. It had gotten very confusing about what models they were running and what the satellites were doing. There were delays with the satellites. There was a lot of fluff to look past. The Europeans, in contrast, seemed to be running a very tight ship. So there's an opportunity there to do things like move to a modern cloud system from the old National Weather Service mainframes. The challenge, though, is that you do have a global atmosphere and you have a global predictions that are dependent on the exchange of data. And as soon as you have private data, you begin to have more limits on who uses that data. And so, if we are going to privatize some of our observations, we need to make sure we do it in a way that doesn't break the global observation system, because it would be very hard to put back together.
And so when you say that, is it also the case that if one of these private organizations were to say, like, sorry, U.S. federal government, we're not going to sell this to you, then we'd be like, oh, we've let our things deprecate and we can't predict weather?
It's more likely scenario, and this has been an active discussion, is we'll sell you the data, but you can't share it with the German Weather Service. You can't share it with the Mexican Weather Service. You can't share it with the European Center for Medium Range Weather Forecasts. And that's not productive. The system is too integrated. Forecasters are too reliant on the multiple weather models. And there's a really important point here, which I want to kind of inject, which is that, we keep talking about the forecast, but the forecast is only as good as the decisions you make with it. You could have a perfect weather forecast, but if no one listens to you, then that forecast is useless. You could have a great, 8-day forecast that's as good as a 2-day forecast was, 10 years ago. And no one cares if you're not making decisions, with that forecast. So it's both the kind of technical piece of, okay, is the data being shared? Is it properly kind of entering the bloodstream of these global models? And then it's also what comes out. Is there enough kind of competition of ideas of different forecasts that are coming out of the systems that we can, that the people who are making decisions from those forecasts can actually get a diversity of opinion that becomes productive, that helps save more lives.
So when you say diversity of opinion, are you meaning like someone opens their phone and they say like, oh, Weather App 1 says 35% chance of rain. Weather App 2 says 70%. Weather App 3 says 0. Or what do you mean by like diversity of opinion there?
Well, I'll put it in more dramatic terms. If let's say you're a weather forecaster in Texas and Weather Model 1 says it's going to rain 8 inches in 2 hours, and you say, that's nuts, I can't believe that. And Weather App 2 says, or Weather Model 2 says, no, it's only going to rain 6 inches, which is also unbelievable. If you didn't have the kind of that confirmation, that sort of competition among the models, both to improve over time and also for a forecast in the moment, you have less confidence in that forecast. And if you have less confidence, you have less ability to convince the people who are going to make decisions based on that forecast to act. One of the trends alongside the privatization is, of course, the increase in extreme weather. And so you have forecasts that look like nothing anyone's ever seen before. Rainfall totals that are different. That used to be a 1,000-year storm and now is a 10-year storm or a 5-year storm. And so it's having not just the best forecast, but a sort of system of forecasts that allows you to confidently make those decisions is really a crucial part of saving lives with the weather forecast.
So for meteorologists, they're getting different versions of models. Like they'll get like a European model, an American model, maybe something else. And then is it your understanding that they use sort of their expertise, their experience to say like, you know what, where I live, this model tends to do better. Or when it's the fall, this is what predicts it. Or how do they sort of make the determination what they're going to say to their audiences?
Yeah. So it's, I mean, yes, they are kind of scratching their chins and saying, you know, this kind of feels more right than this. But it's also that the precision of it doesn't matter as much as what the actionable insight is or what. So, you know, so if one model says it's going to snow 10 inches in New York City tomorrow and the other model says it's going to snow, you know, 12 inches tomorrow, in both cases, you're going to close schools and you're going to close schools before it starts to snow, which used to be inconceivable. So it is the job of the professional meteorologist now less to predict the weather than to predict the impacts.
So, okay, let's get to like a bigger picture on this. The United States federal government takes this on. Sometimes when they take on big things, there's something that breaks down or doesn't work out that well. Are there downsides to us trying to forecast, or is it like there's always a net good for us trying to figure these things out?
Yeah, well, I mean, again, there's a very long tradition of weather forecasting being a public good, you know, being something that governments do for their citizens. There's a more recent tradition of forecasts that are accurate enough to have real economic impacts, much less kind of competitive economic impacts. So there's now more economic value if you can, you know, have a better weather forecast, whether for your airline or for your you know, beach umbrella business or whatever it is. So is there a moment when this is something that governments shouldn't do? The key recognition is that we do have a long tradition of international exchange, and the weather is always international. You know, if you stop the international exchange, you know, you end up with a 2-day forecast, you know, not a 10-day forecast. And the other key thing here is that, you know, we have that responsibility to safety, but also an ability to offer that equally, you know, to not create a situation where, you know, some people are evacuating from Florida ahead of a hurricane, you know, 3 days earlier because they have better weather models.
And I suppose that is a risk if we go this privatized route, where it might be like people who are paying for the private data, if there's some world in which that's better than whatever the public data is, they'll have an easier time fleeing something that's dangerous, but they're also probably at a less vulnerable place to begin with.
I mean, I think we're definitely already there. Like, I think that's, you know, I think that's, we're definitely there. So, that's in some ways, I guess, a kind of inevitable outcome of these new systems. But the differences, I think, are still relatively small when there is the risk that the differences in the information we have access to become bigger. And there's also a huge, because it's about, you know, because it interfaces with so many other things the government does, there's a huge trust factor as well. You know, so in a hurricane example, in a storm, in a, you know, river flooding, you know, it is all about that, you know, who, you know, I mean, again, in the Texas tragedy last summer, you know, some of the reports said that, you know, the weather forecast was spot on. The National Weather Service meteorologist, warning coordinator, you know, which is a specific person whose job it is to interact with local authorities, you know, they were, you know, more or less on point. But the breakdown then gets, you know, more and more local. You know, the breakdown then, you know, is in the emergency managers and the ability for them to trust the meteorologists and believe that this, the extent of what's being forecast is actually going to happen. And to think about that coming from a private organization rather than government means, like, at what point, like what's left of government in that case? You're asking, you know, different governments to trust each other, and if you privatize one but not another, then how do you maintain those bonds of trust?
And I guess sort of thinking about trust, something that I liked about your approach to this book and also what you did with your book On the Internet is you're trying to make something that is sort of an invisible system, something that's visible. Do you feel like 7 years on, the book has been out for a bit, that it is more visible to Americans what the government does that underlies this technology, or are there things that we still don't appreciate?
The National Weather Service has been in the news more because of the argument over how much it should be funded and how many forecasters we should have and what government should be doing. So you have a kind of more vibrant debate about what its function is. That's partly why we're having this conversation now. So in that sense, it's sort of more apparent. I think also because I think people do use the weather forecast differently than they did 10 years ago, not just because we have it so accessible in our phones, but because it's kind of quietly gotten better. You know, we're, I don't know what the good version of, like, you know, frogs in a boiling pot is, but like we now kind of make plans for the weekend on Tuesday because we're pretty confident with that Saturday forecast. So I think that's there. It's tricky, though. I mean, there's so much where, there some of the government, the importance of government's role in this is hidden behind, is hidden behind our smartphone screens, is hidden behind the Apple weather app or the.
Yeah, when you pull up an app, it doesn't say like this is powered by U.S. taxpayer dollars.
No.
Or this is like, you know, the government helping you figure out what you're going to do this weekend. Yeah, so it is still, it's not legible or it's not immediately apparent that that's where this data is coming from. In terms of overall grades for the National Weather Service or the idea that the federal government's going to do this at all, where would you give the idea of weather prediction? Like, is it something that we should always do? Is it something that we should move away from? I feel like you're going to say it's a good that we should always keep providing.
Yeah, I mean, it is one of the core things that governments can do to protect their citizens. You could imagine private forecasting that is, ringing the alarm about a coming hurricane or a tornado, but you still need, a tornado might be a different case, but let's stick with a hurricane where it's a kind of regional scale, but you still rely on, we are still, deep in the assumption that it is government that is going to both, make some of those decisions about evacuation and also, help with the safety and cleanup. And that's debatable, but we're still so deeply in it that to begin to think about pulling another thread out of that web, especially at a moment when we do have more frequent and extreme storms, is challenging.
Andrew, thank you so much for talking with me today. Is there anything else that we didn't hit on that you think we should know about?
No. I'm glad we got to the impact of the forecast because that is such an, it is like that, it is kind of where the rubber hits the road with a lot of this. That does come into not just the kind of technical apparatus of it, but how it does actually end up helping citizens.
Okay. Andrew Blum, thank you so much for chatting with us. I learned a ton about weather. I learned a ton about predictions. I learned a ton about why it is important that the government continues this sort of work. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. And I think I hear it just started to rain here as well. So our timing
perfect.
Is good.
As always, government that doesn't suck doesn't try to put any sort of political goal or endpoint, but we do want to arm you with the facts so that you, me, we the people can do a better job of assessing what it is our government is doing on our behalf. Government That Doesn't Suck is hosted by Professor Greg Jackson and me, Professor Lindsay Cormack. The show is produced by History That Doesn't Suck in association with Pave Studios. Executive producers are Greg Jackson, Dossie McCraw, and Max Cutler. We are a part of the Rewind Network. For more information, go to gtdspodcast.com.